Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcoat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews.
By students, for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
Welcome back to the Shortcoat Podcast. I'm Dave Etler. Dr. Paul Farmer is sort of the rock god of global health. In addition to being a physician, he's also a medical anthropologist. He's the chief of Brigham and Women's Division of Global Health Equity. He's a professor of medicine at Harvard, and he's the UN Special Advisor to the Secretary General on Community-Based Medicine and Lessons from Haiti. He's also the founding director of Partners in Health, an international nonprofit that provides direct healthcare services, research, and advocacy to the sick and impoverished around the world in places like Liberia and Haiti and even here in the U.S. He's an incredibly busy and influential guy, and last week he flew in from Liberia to spend the entire day here with us at the Carver College of Medicine. And one of the things you notice about Dr. Farmer is that although he's clearly a celebrity in his field, it does not dampen his enthusiasm, idealism, and the pleasure he takes in meeting students who share his passion for understanding and changing how healthcare is delivered to the world's neediest people. So it's a particular honor that Petra Hahn, Katie Ryken, Josh Bleicher, Jordan Harbaugh-Williams, and Greg Youngtum got to chat with him for this week's show to explore the differences between charity, development, and liberation medicine. It's Farmer's emphasis on the latter and his view that the poor deserve preferential treatment that makes him such a force in global health.
So for our listeners who might not be familiar with the topic, I was hoping the group and especially you could kind of define what liberation medicine is and how it's different than other approaches to global health, like a development approach and a more charitable approach, and what makes it, liberation medicine unique.
Well, I mean, only if everybody promises to really help me out here, because of course I couldn't possibly define that by myself. A more modest and appropriate approach for me would just be to say a little bit about how I've found some of the ideas helpful. And these are ideas that I got out of liberation theology. And you did too, I know. That's sometimes from the same guy,
right? Yeah.
Gutierrez. So let me just start and then open it, go back to you. First of all, I didn't know anything about theology or didn't have any interest in it either when I was in college. In fact, spent a little bit of my college time reacting to a Catholic childhood where it's hard really to muster a lot of interest in. Well, it was hard for me. I just wasn't.
Yeah.
And then I did get interested in Latin America, because when I went to college in 1982, the wars in Central America were heating up, and Archbishop Romero, the Archbishop of El Salvador, was killed in March of 80. Gutierrez was one of his advisors, and both had been involved in Vatican II, which was interesting to me. Mm-hmm. And but again, I'm 20 years old. I'm interested in lots of things, biochemistry major, et cetera. And I really started to pay more attention because of what was in the newspapers, and then reading about Latin America and the implications for some of this and some of these ideas for health and well-being, and particularly medicine. And I knew I wanted to be a doctor. And so you could call that a sociological start. Mm-hmm. This is all before I went to Haiti. But by the time I went to Haiti, I'd read a little bit more. I found the theology very hard going. I was just telling Josh this. The actual God talk, and as Gutierrez called it, I found it not as interesting as a history book or a biochemistry book until later. And then I started uncovering some ideas, really through reading, that I find to this day very helpful. Structural violence, a preferential option for the poor, and accompaniment. And you know, on first blush, you know, the preferential option for the poor, I didn't really understand the depth of it until I went to Haiti after college. And then I thought, wow, you're saying that, I'm not going to use theological terms, you can push me later, but not yet.
No, no need.
You're saying that because I'd heard people say all the time, you know, the poor deserve good medical care just as much as anyone else. And this theory was saying, oh no, they deserve it more than anyone else. And I thought, well, that's a safeguard. That's a way to think we can't give second-rate services, and I was interested in healthcare services, to people because they're poor. And to this day, I find it inspiring. And same for those other ideas, which we can go into if we have time. So liberation medicine can mean something as straightforward as, can we be liberated from unnecessary suffering caused by disease? And the mission statement of Harvard Medical School is to address human suffering caused by disease, to liberate ourselves from unnecessary suffering, meaning do we have the tools of the trade to prevent suffering, to palliate them, to cure them? Very often we do, and if we made a preferential option for the poor in administering them, prevention, palliation, cure, the return on what it is we do would be enormous. Now that is not a short little answer, but
I think it's a good answer. It's a good place to start. For me, one of the kind of defining factors of liberation medicine and the theology behind it has been that once you begin to see the structural violence and the injustices, there's an automatic kind of moral obligation almost to change those structures. Whereas in other, approaches to global poverty, you know, maybe somebody working at the United Nations or the International Monetary Fund or, you know, those kind of economists and bankers and those policymakers often approach poverty simply with the goal of managing it instead of really trying to change the structure that created it. And even people who might go to developing countries for a week or two at a time have the best intentions, but I've noticed that they always come back with some level of frustration that they couldn't do as much as they wanted to because the structure in which they were working was lacking. And so to me, this liberation medicine approach is an excellent answer, or at least an excellent lens through which to view that situation and try to wrestle with some of those difficult problems.
Exactly. So is liberation medicine any different than viewing health as a human right?
That to me?
To anyone. To I just don't understand. I don't understand why thinking about
human rights
requires theology.
And that's the thing, is that the theology can be, I kind of stacked the deck a little bit. You don't have to talk about it in theological terms. That's why I wanted to use the term liberation medicine.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think this is a very fruitful avenue of thought. I think that if you take three different paradigms, health as a human right, and whether or not paradigm is the right word, I don't know, but health as a human right, health and social justice, and liberation medicine, that you can make what you want out of them, right? So, but they're all, in a sense, safety net ideas. And safety net is compared to what? Well, some of the people you're talking about who clearly go into development banks or development institutions with the idea of making life better, their backup paradigms are, if you invest in health, you'll grow the economy, right? In other words, health is good for wealth. That's the dominant, you know, theology in a way of that world,
yep.
Right? And then There's another one that's very common in public health, and that is public health as a public good.
Right.
And also helpful, you know. It's not like if you have an epidemic of tuberculosis and you say, well, this is, you know, it's on you to get diagnosed and treated and bring yourself to cure, then you're not going to stop transmission. Same for Ebola, same for influenza, you know. Same for road traffic. If you don't wear seatbelts and you don't respect speed laws, there's no public good for public health, right? So each of those paradigms, if you were to say the bottom three, which I'm calling the top three, those are the safety nets for poor people, right? Because they can get left out of the others, or as I was saying earlier today, they can be left into public goods for public health paradigms in a way that's largely punitive to them and frightening to them. And I've seen it happen many times, right? So whether or not theology is useful, I think neither you or I disagree that it is if it is, if it's not, if it's not. These are structural violence, preferential options of the poor, and accompaniment are not really, I got them from theology, but you can get them from music for all I care, right? Accompaniment.
It's or the same end product, I guess.
It's the same end product. And I would say it's wise for medical students and practitioners, or nursing students and practitioners, or all those who care about health and well-being among the poor, to understand the difference between these foundational notions of, you know, everybody, that is a human rights framework. It says everybody's human. The one thing I would add, though, is the push that's most shocking to me is not the structural violence push. It's irresponsible not to understand structural violence.
Exactly.
It's the preferential option of the poor. The idea there's an actual preference. That's hardcore.
Yeah.
And we need to master the, you know, health is good for wealth. We need to understand that stuff. We need to understand how public health paradigms work. And you know, in medical school, at least, we're not taught a lot about these things, right? We have to get better at it. I mentioned healthcare financing and how ignorant we all are about healthcare financing. You know, if health equals wealth, then why can't we say we better invest in this if we want that? And very few of the doctors I know can do that,
exactly.
Or nurses, or any other clinician.
I think that's changing a little bit over the past 5 years, and Lancet commissioned Global Health 2035 about investing in health.
Yep.
Is certainly a move in that direction. And in that paper, as well as the commission behind that paper, they really push pro-poor policies, which is essentially the same way of what you've been describing. So I feel like it is possible to marry this liberation medicine, whatever we're calling it, obligation, moral obligation to help the poor, to provide healthcare as a human right, however you want to call it, with these financial arguments. And the gap between these is not as large as we might think. I think that economists and physicians or human rights activists just speak different languages sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I think in the past few years, everyone's somewhat beginning to realize we have the same end goal.
Yeah.
We just need to learn how to communicate a little bit better.
You know, I'm so glad you said that. First of all, that is a landmark advance. And indeed, a lot of other endeavors should be modeled on that. And the only reason I called the human rights paradigm as a safety net is picking up on your point of the sort of radical commitment to social justice. But it's much better to consider those as complementary paradigms. Public goods for public health, economic development, requiring investments, right? And healthcare as a human right. They're all very complementary. And I would just go, being the oldest one here, I would say more. You know, when you're with a certain audience, unless you're trying to win an argument, it's not a bad idea to figure out which one of those paradigms is most compelling to the audience you're trying to sway, if the goal is the same. So, Josh, I couldn't agree more. That document, the Lancet Commission, has been extremely powerful. And if you look, if you go into the data around what happened in Africa, you know, the great reversals at the late 20th century around very different economic policies than the ones that, you know, I think we would advocate around the table, that one of the things that turned them around was investments in treating AIDS, TB, and malaria. And those were PEPFAR, a bilateral program with a bunch of countries, and the Global Fund. And the speed at which you can see turnarounds, I mean, Rwanda, we talked about already, is stunning. And whether, you know, you go to the president of Rwanda and say, you know, it'd be really make a lot of sense for the economic growth of your country if you were to invest a lot in healthcare and education, which might be the thing I would say to a head of state, or, you know, these epidemics, these camp epidemics after the war and genocide are now out of control, we need public goods for public health. Or, you know, you want to show all Rwandans that you respect rights, you should make sure that you have a pro-poor, pro-woman, pro-rural set of policies. And that's exactly those complementary paradigms were brought in, all of them, in that particular space. Sorry, that was more than you bargained for.
Along those lines, in the United States and in our medical education now, we have words for structural violence and blaming that structural violence on individual patients. And those words for us are words like non-compliance and non-adherence. And I think the most frustrating thing for me as a medical student is already inherent in my education. I'm learning to think that it's my patient's responsibility to get well. It's not my responsibility necessarily to create a good program. And I think in understanding how you work and all of the different avenues in which you work, how do you explain things like structural violence to somebody who has no idea what that is?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I gotta say, I was surprised that you guys took up for your journal group that reading. And I was grateful too, because some of that stuff was written for clinicians, right? But I just don't usually teach it myself. I mean, I wouldn't go into rounds and say, you know, you have a patient come in whose life, let's say in Boston, whose life has been marginalized by a number of major illnesses, let's say AIDS, mental illness, addiction of some sort, housing instability, mm-hmm. gender violence, the list goes on. And, you know, and I'm the infectious disease attending. I don't go in and say, hey, let's talk about structural violence. They want to know what are the right meds, what are the right doses, what can we... And so I'm just saying thank you, because I do think that it's important to understand as a clinician, but we got to get better at making it compelling. And it's probably not by writing these long-winded articles that you were good enough to read.
And I'm not even sure it's just making it compelling, but making people not get so uncomfortable and like antagonistic about it and denying its very existence. Like, people get so angry about the Black Lives Matter movement and can't fathom that anything that they do in a system which has benefited them for so, so long could be anything but the right way, I guess.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Well, you know, having a hermeneutic of generosity to your colleagues and, you know, fellow clinicians, nurses, your faculty, because I run into this a lot, as you might imagine, is probably part of the way to get at what Petra's saying, which is how do we, for someone who's never heard this term, and frankly might never find it useful, like liberation medicine, you know, you nonetheless know that there are forces that make it very difficult for people to adhere to a complex regimen, and that they can be detailed, described, and removed, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, our system is so inconvenient for, let's just say, let's just say someone who's unlikely to engender that kind of visceral negative feeling, the frail elderly with multiple diagnoses. Really, we want to make them drive through the kind of snow and stuff I saw last night to go pick up something that should be brought to them or receive some therapy that should be delivered by our community health worker. I mean, the system is just set up the wrong way. And so it engenders frustration. And it's a form of structural violence because you take a problem that is created by a system that's not going to deliver what you need and then move responsibility to the most vulnerable, most frail person in the equation, the patient. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that's just happened for time immemorial. The way I can say the way I usually do it, and I've never not run into it, by the way. I mean, new residents in Haiti, 20-something-year-olds, some of the first things they'll say to me, surgical residents, internal medicine, pediatrics, they'll say, well, you're an anthropologist too. What do we do about witchcraft and sorcery? And what I really want to say is nothing. It's not your job, actually. Your job is not to even have an opinion about it. Your job is to make sure that this patient gets these are middle class patients, or, you know, they're asking sincerely, but they're crediting this belief, this cognitive belief inside the patient's mind with the ability to determine the outcome of their medical intervention. Mm-hmm. It could be a surgical intervention. And I'm saying, no, you don't worry about that. We work with community health workers. We work with others who are more skilled in this arena. Your job is to provide the best care you can inside the hospital and in outpatient clinic, and then work with colleagues who can help you. So in a way, instead of having the frustrating argument about structural violence, we have the more promising argument about outcomes. Mm. Like, do you want this patient to be cured? They all want the patient to get better or lessen suffering. You know, I've never not seen that. Even in these bitter kind of discussions that have been going on in the United States and plenty of other countries,
yeah.
I can't think of times when I've seen physicians, clinicians wish something ill on a patient. And that's a good thing, right?
Yeah.
And so if we can switch we can understand enough about structural violence to move the topic to something that clinicians can actually do. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, they might reasonably say, hey, I'm not the architect of racism in, you know, Ferguson or Baltimore. Well, I didn't shell out the middle of the industrial economy in Pennsylvania. They didn't, right? I didn't repeal, I didn't put in Jim Crow in the American South. But, you know, it's over their heads, it's over our heads, right? But look at some of the things that aren't. Making sure that we can deliver care for chronic disease. We can't do it without community health workers, but we can do it. And our voices as doctors and nurses and clinicians have never been united around this yet. Mm. Have they?
No.
And we could do it. We could say, our version of accountable care means that we're in charge of getting the patient the best possible care. And not saying, no, you patient are in charge of, you know, making sure that your shunt works when you need dialysis.
So it's more about not sitting down and having a lecture about structural violence, more about redirecting towards, like, easily accomplished goals of care.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about for you guys. Because you guys are wanting to have this. But I don't think it is. In my experience, it's not as useful for the whole...
In terms of, like, education and
no, that's
stuff
right.
like that. Okay.
Now, so here's another thing, that another way of doing it. It's very complementary. And we teach social medicine this way at Harvard. What we say is understanding these factors is not optional because outcomes are determined by them. And your responsibility, you've signed up to be a good clinician. You haven't signed up to change the social determinants of disease. You know, you didn't. You're not doing a degree in poverty reduction, or housing improvement, or job security. You're doing a degree in medicine. Therefore, understanding how these social determinants get into your including racism, get into your patients' bodies, and deciding where you intervene to get them out. That's part of your job. So it's not a frustrating discussion about structural violence so much of what is it we do in our work to minimize the impact of structural violence on outcome. Now you could do that all the way, you can do primary prevention, right? Don't let kids get asthma by having horsehair in the, you know, in their houses, walls in Boston. But doctors don't tear down, you know, houses. Somebody, but you can say, okay, well, how about making this kid's coming in to the emergency room 10 times in 3 months and doesn't know how to take his inhaler. You know, that's starting to sound like a pediatrician's job, right? So I'm just arguing for, not for your hard pipe-hitting group here. I find reading about social violence consoling and instructive. But that doesn't mean everybody does. However, on this end, we have agreement. The end being, we have to improve outcomes. That's why people go into clinical work. They want people to get better. And it doesn't matter if they're a neurosurgeon or a primary care doctor or a hospice nurse. You know, there is a point at which we can engage people. Mm-hmm. And I'm thrilled that you guys are reading about structural violence. But I want you to feel like you can use other paradigms. Same thing for liberation medicine. Use other paradigms of competence, humility, you know, good outcomes, suffering, reducing suffering, and caregiving. Mm-hmm. Those are of wide appeal. Mm-hmm. Sorry, is that a speech?
No, that was good. That was good.
We need a core group of people who do want to understand the links between structural violence and how to get it out of the body. Whether or not that is going to be general competence for medicine and nursing, I have my doubts. Yeah.
But I think it will make us better clinicians if we do
better
understand
teachers.
It.
Better teachers too, right? Because it's complex stuff. It's like if you don't have any staff stuff, space, or systems to provide care for your sick family member, why is that a cultural construct? In whose culture is it celebrated to have no tools of the trade, right? Mm-hmm. In whose culture is it celebrated to go bury your dead father yourself without any help, without gloves or a bag or a shovel? This has nothing to do with culture, right? And this is very common kind of poor analysis, and not poor analysis, that's too harsh, but people don't understand social life very well. And you're not being trained to do it, so we do it at Harvard by saying everyone's going to take social medicine.
So what like core competencies do you recommend in a medical school, like when you're talking about everyone has to take social medicine? Because, for example, I think it would be beneficial, like we don't learn about other healthcare systems at all in medical school. That's not a requirement. Like I've never in class learned about the UK's national health system or anything. Oh. And I think that alone would be beneficial in trying to figure out how to suss out how we can better provide care for everyone and how we can have a better healthcare system. Do you agree?
Well, and it's even on us as students to, you know, if we want to address these ideas, it's on us. You know, we all are in global health class where we talk about national health systems or structural violence and understanding the social determinants of health. But
they're all elective.
Right, it's all elective. It's not something that's mandated saying this will make your outcomes better and what we care about is good patient outcomes.
Well, yeah. You know, first of all, I'd love to share, and I'm going to pass it over to you, I'd love to share our course with you. It keeps getting reformulated, but you're welcome to it. And I'm not sure it's some answer, but I would in the interest of playing devil's advocate, which I know, Petra, you love.
The devil. Love devil's advocate.
I would say that one thing we really shouldn't teach is cultural competency. Mm. Cultural humility is what we should teach. Mm. You know, yeah. Because just understanding that there's so much we don't know about a person, a family, a place, a pathology. It's just better to go in saying, we got a lot to learn if we're going to help this person or this family. And that we can mandate. I mean, that should be part of the ethics of the profession, that it's not so much competency. I mean, I've studied and worked in Haiti for 30 years, speak the language, but that doesn't mean I consider myself culturally competent, you know, as a Haitian. Mm-hmm. And it'd be just as good to say, well, you gotta have some cultural humility, because even after 30-something years, I still don't understand.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
You know, healthcare financing, other systems, I mean, it's kind of embarrassing for us as a profession to be so illiterate in this stuff.
Yeah.
And I think it is on us, you know. And that doesn't take away from pathophysiology and some of the most exciting research innovations to have a basic literacy in healthcare systems. Mm-hmm. So you were going to say something?
Yeah, I was just going off of when we were talking about our education. I was thinking back to all of our lectures, and we have a lecture on kind of public health type stuff, and we talk about disparities a lot. Like, there's a lot of graphs that show, okay, African-American males live less long than white males, etc. But we're never taught what we can do about it.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really leads to a lot of disengagement with the material. Yeah. Because then you get people, well, I didn't create it, and I don't know what to do about it.
Yeah.
But I think where your writings and you connect with so many people is you provide the practical aspect, and also appealing to the morals of the situation. I think that can really engage people more.
I think you're right, and I think you said it better than I did, because, you know, laying out the disparities, or even the fact that they're growing, without countering, yes, but here's seven ways that we can easily reverse these directions, or if not easily, we can reverse the directions. And they're all within our reach. And I think more exercises like that, whether they be theoretical exercises, case studies of reversals, of improvement, that's why I mentioned some of the Rwandan ones. I mean, come on, 20 years ago, this place is at the bottom of the barrel. Highest infant mortality, juvenile mortality, maternal mortality, camp epidemics of everything. And now the steepest declines in mortality ever documented anywhere at any time in the world. What happened? Like, we should learn about that, because these are policy interventions, it's true, but they're also pragmatic interventions. And if you look at African American males, you know, in a some famous study, you know, like Harlem Hospital, Harlem versus Bangladesh, the understanding how racism gets in the body and how you get it out can be recast as an implementation task that involves physicians, public health workers, community health workers, you know, other people whose job it is to improve, you know, health and well-being. And nothing's going to make me believe for a minute that those are not reversible pathologies. And you know, it's just hard to have the other conversation, which also needs to be had. You know, the one you brought up, that you know, there is a toleration of the notion that black lives don't matter, right? We tolerate that in our society still. It's also an important conversation to have. Now, how much the med students want to get involved, they're citizens of this country, by and large, they should, but that part's our job. And you know, the detaching, this I hadn't really said very clearly. Risk of illness is step one risk of dying from illness, that's a whole other set of processes. Mm-hmm. Like, I already have asthma, okay? But I can get my medications, you know, even when I'm showing up in a city that I have where I don't have a doctor, right? So, you know, you can have HIV infect 30% of the young women of Lesotho, and yet you can see mortality rates from HIV plummet because you've disconnected the risk of mortality by using the tools of the trade, which are called diagnosis, staging, and treatment of that disease. And that most doctors and nurses feel like that's their job. And so the optimism part of it is like, be excited, because now's a great time to get involved in medicine. And we just have to learn to work with other people on this team. Mm-hmm.
And there are examples everywhere like this. I love the contrast you drew in that article of the two AIDS programs. The one in Baltimore where they identified all of the barriers to care.
It's the same AIDS program, isn't that a great thing?
Yeah.
They actually fixed it. It was the same people.
Uh-huh.
Sorry, I interrupted.
And then the Emory program where they have the state-of-the-art clinic.
Right.
In the heart of the state where the epidemic is in the poor community, but they don't provide transport, the care costs something. And the Baltimore program, which takes away the barriers, doesn't address structural violence, but takes away the barriers to care, have close to 100% low viral loads. And the one in Emory, even though it's a state-of-the-art facility, has 15%. And so that's really empowering as a learner to say, all you have to do is just address these simple barriers. It's really not that hard, and you can drastically improve the efficacy.
So glad you read that. I'd forgotten that. I wrote that.
Exciting stuff.
There's two parts to it that are worth saying. Knowing a lot of the people involved in both the programs, the quality of the clinicians is no better at Johns Hopkins than at Emory. Claims to the contrary that would surely be made, you know, as with every one of these.
By all parties.
Yeah, by all the teaching hospitals, right? It's the system, the system, like you said, of first of all going out and recognizing that the program wasn't working in Baltimore. And this is before ART, right? Mm-hmm. Before antiretroviral therapy. It was insurance status, race, income that was determining who got in for their meds, et cetera. So they studied the barriers, removed them. You said it great. In the Emory program, the clinic is even better. I mean, it looks better. I mean, the ID doctors and others are, you know, they're just as good. But it's those systemic problems that had not at that time been fully addressed. And I also think that's exciting. I mean, these are relatively modest interventions. And then the race becomes the race to the top. Who can have the, who can catch up with Rwanda to have low viral loads.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, and I think for us too, it's encouraging because we often as Americans think, well, you know, Rwanda, what's going on there? How can that possibly be better than here? And then, but that also, that cultural inhumility almost even allows us to say, well, if it can happen there, why isn't it happening here?
I think that's a good thing.
And I think it's a good thing too.
You know, I was talking to, okay, this sounds funny, but I was in Liberia yesterday talking to someone I think is the world's, or this country's greatest infectious disease doctor. And he is an architect of PEPFAR and a good friend of mine and a mentor. I won't mention him by name, but it's Tony Fauci. And, I called him a couple months ago. He had been taking care of a colleague of ours with Ebola, and, you know, we've been working together. And we were in touch regularly. But I called him, and he was saying, you know, we could really learn a lot about eradicating AIDS in American cities from Rwanda. And I wanted to say, I mean, to have someone in his position, I mean, of course you knew that before, but, you know, I imagine he'll be saying things like that publicly, and that will be really good, not just for its shock value, although that won't be bad, but because if you can do it there, you can certainly do it here with some systems changes.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So I was pretty stoked when I...
Pretty stoked.
That's not a term I use. I think I must be showing off.
Are you?
As the kids of our generation say.
You're picking up some stuff from us.
I am.
Lucky you.
So earlier, Dr. Farmer, you had mentioned some of the ways that structural violence and racism and those things can kind of embody themselves in the people that they affect. And for me, one of the most telling, or one kind of way that happens that I've seen is kind of a conditioned silence. That it's hard for certain people to advocate for themselves, sometimes even to just communicate with their doctors. Jordan, yeah. I know that you have an experience with that. Do you want to tell that story?
Yeah, this is a cool, you'll like this one. It makes you look really good. So this summer I had the privilege of working with a really brilliant undergrad named Alexis Doyle, and she came to me with this project, Women's Empowerment Project. And yes, I realize the irony that I'm talking about a Women's Empowerment Project, but her idea was to teach women how to make soap, economically empowering them and also giving them soap to address the issue of parasitic infection that's rampant in rural Guatemala. And one thing that I noticed, and I just kind of noted it in the back of my mind, it wasn't something that affected the project at the time, but the women we worked with were just very quiet, very timid, and would always defer to us whenever we had a decision to make in the project. We would always ask them, and they say, whatever you guys think is best. And then fast forward to later on that fall, Alexis went to the PIH clinic in Chiapas, and she worked with some of the acompañadores and taught them how to make soap. And she said they were ecstatic, and they were just dreaming of all these business ideas that they could, how they could sell it in the community and have it be a big thing. And she just thought the difference between how these women were able to just speak and dream and were coming up with all these ideas was really interesting. And so it really got me thinking about what goes into empowering these women, aside from the economic piece, which we know is really important, and what's a really important part of the accompañador program.
That's good to hear. When you started telling me about the Guatemalan, you know, this for an outsider, this is impassive wall that's hard to break through for all kinds of reasons that are amenable to study, I was also thinking of the women in Chiapas and how I had been there not too long ago and couldn't get a word in edgewise. Which is a good thing. It's a good thing. You know, you did say beyond the economic empowerment, which is probably because you want to cut me off at the roots, and because I think a lot of it does have to do with agency. Mm-hmm. And agency is cultural agency and family agency and all kinds of things. I mean, the ability to make choices. But it is deeply tied in economic conditions. But I think you're right to push me and say beyond economic. One of the things that I saw there, which I learned something from, this is not too long ago, where there's a group of wonderful young Mexican physicians who work in Chiapas, and they're all about a head taller than the people in Chiapas, and they're from a lot of them are from northern Mexico, right? And so my daughter was there with me, and she was going on a college tour. You know, she was looking at colleges, and she then came home and said to her family, the rest of her family, of course, dad's taking her on a college tour, they should know it'll be an unusual college tour. What was your favorite part of your college tour? She didn't say Princeton or Duke or Tulane. She said, oh, the Mexican doctors. But there was one of the, these guys, and they're mostly guys, these young doctors were really respectful, and they hadn't lived around poor Mexicans either, you know. And one of them was about to do a meditation workshop, and I thought, I'm getting the hell out of here. I do not want to see some tall, you know, northern Mexican teach, you know, these battered ladies how to meditate. So, but I was wrong, because they loved it. And first of all, they were talking, and then they were meditating. And next thing I know, I fell off my chair. I fell asleep meditating, and which scared them a little bit. But the story I was going to say is that this young man didn't lead the discussion, but it was an easy discussion they were having about very difficult topics. You know, about gender violence, and it was so different from the stuff I'd seen on the other side of the border. And had written about, and you know, I think, in addition to economic, but not in it, without it, that is, women right. need jobs, and every time women have control over resources, including, you know, that their agency is enhanced, but education and formal education is so tightly tied to, you know, improved health outcomes. I mean, that's like a public health 101. And you know, I've seen it. I've seen this all fail too. I've seen efforts to have public discussions of these matters turn ugly, you know, in other settings. But there's something about this affirmation of the material needs, of the value and dignity of everyone, of the engagement of people who, frankly, are not from that part of Mexico, but from a very different set of backgrounds, of the fact that they lived there, the clinicians lived there for a year at a time, that gives them authority to have conversations that really wouldn't otherwise concern them. I don't know, there is something special about that place. And of course, the community health workers live and work there all the time. And you know, it's just a very different situation than you see in most places. I don't want to romanticize the power of the community health worker or the skill set, but I wouldn't want to romanticize the power or skill set of a neurosurgeon either, right? I mean, should you get a neurosurgeon who's, you know, done a complicated procedure, putting in a shunt, for, let's say, the kind of illness I might take care of, a parasitic infestation, should that surgeon go and be doing directly observed therapy of the antiparasitics and at home? No. You know, there's this division of labor. Now, I was a long way away from the trust issue, but one thing that I've learned in the last 2 years working on Ebola is the profound distrust between officialdom and the people most likely to get and die from Ebola is rooted in a century of uncaring approaches to public health that are focused largely on stopping epidemics but not taking care of people. And you know, that's not the way it is in that program in Mexico, and I hope that's not the way it is in any of the programs. It's like you say to the surgical residents on the first day of when they say, what do we do about sorcery? It's like, nothing, it's not your job, you know? You do your job. And of course I say it more politely than that, but you know, the caregiving piece of it is we gotta make that front and center in everything we do in medicine.
That's awesome. Absolutely true.
Thanks.
And we're excited to be part of the people that put that at the front and center of medicine.
Well, you know, this has been, this has been a stimulating and uplifting for me too, you know, to come all the way back from Liberia and end up in a little bit of a snow shower and to be able to meet you all and have that level of discussion all day long has been very uplifting. someone asked me today, and I want to say it here, that, how do you not get discouraged in work like this? And I gave a whole bunch of reasons. The main one being, of course, is that with the tools of our trade, our collective tools, that's not just doctors, but doctors, nurses, community health workers, lab capacity, new therapeutics, preventives, diagnostics, it's so effective what we could do if we go that extra mile, like you said, Jordan. But the other thing is, I get to meet people like you who have not only the same commitments, but a lot more youth on your side. and means you'll have a lot more tools and a lot more, that youthful passion. Just don't let that die away. I didn't, and I'm old. So it's been really a lot of fun, and I wish I were staying longer.
We do too.
I think this is my first podcast.
Really?
What makes something a podcast?
What
makes something a podcast? Sounds like a fruit structure or a leguminous.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Farmer, and we're looking forward to you coming back to Iowa whenever you get the
Me
chance.
Too. Me too. And thank looking forward you. To, being part of the same social justice army, if that's the right metaphor. No matter what it is you do in medicine, by the way.
If you like what you heard on the Short Code Podcast today, leave us a review and some stars on iTunes or Stitcher. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to tell us about your moment of truth. If something strange or wonderful happened to you, if you're annoyed or pleased about something, or if you want to suggest a story idea to us, leave us a message at theshortcoat.com. Do follow and talk to us on Twitter so we can all stay up to date on what's happening at the margins of medicine. The show is made possible by this strange world we live in and a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine, Student Government, and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our intern is Corey Christensen. Our opening music is by Dr. Vox, and our closing music is by C2C. Talk to you in 1 week.